Okay, welcome everybody to the October Guild Training Call with Sean Coyne. My name is Valerie Francis. I'm going to moderate the call today. We did get a few questions in advance, but as we go, if you have more questions, pop them in the chat. We'll get to as many as we can. For those listening on the replay, there are two documents that Sean will go over here in today's call. I will post both of those documents with the recording. So just look below wherever you found this recording and you should see the two documents. Okie dokie, Sean.
Okay.
Over to you.
Okay, great. So I like the way these have been structured recently, which probably has been all year, but I can't remember. But I like doing a little bit of what I've been thinking about lately, kind of lab instruction right now. And then we'll do Q&A and feel free to, ask questions about what I'm going over now in the Q&A. But let me just fly through this so that I can give everybody a sense of kind of what I'm thinking about now. So let me share my screen. There we go. Okay, I did not set this up, so it tells me I have to quit Zoom. So if everybody can hang for a second, I'm gonna quit Zoom and I'll come right back, okay?
I wish I had the Jeopardy music. yes, it gives everyone a chance to look at the documents. Jennifer kindly just posted the link to those documents again in the chat. So everyone have a look at those. I haven't read them yet myself because I just got them. They're hot off the press. Thank you, Rachel. Do you guys have any questions for me while we're waiting for Sean to come back? Anything that I can answer for you? Oh, Sean is back. You back, Sean? Let's just see.
All right, back. Let's hope this works now. Let's see, share desktop. Yep. Okay, I think it works. Let me go to the doc. There we go. Everybody can see that? Thumbs up? Yeah, okay, great. Okay, so what I wanna talk today about is sort of, a lot of people ask me like, what do you do? Like, what's your thinking process? How did you even come to start thinking about story at these different levels of analysis? So I thought I'd walk everybody through the way I think through this problem over and over and over again. And obviously I haven't come to all of the solutions yet, but we're scratching, right? We're scratching at some higher resolution understanding of storytelling. So basically the biggest thing that I've discovered over the last 10 years is that problem formulation is your biggest problem. So once you figure out the problem, it's not that difficult to solve. So what is required, and Charles Kettering was a famous inventor. I think he ran General Motors. So a problem well stated is a problem half solved, and that's absolutely true. All right, so I always love to go back to first principles, even when, say, I'm getting a manuscript to edit. I'll start running through this so that I can sort of tune my mind into thinking clearly about what the why the hell I'm doing what I'm doing, right? So I like to go all the way up to the top of the mountain. And so what's the meta story problem for the storyteller, right? Like, so if you're working with a client or you're the writer, what's your big problem? You know, so I think the big problem that everybody's confronting is how are you going to construct a story that sells, right? So how is it going to sell? And ideally a story that's going to sell forever, right? So if you were to say to yourself, what would be the ideal situation at the end of my telling this story? Well, I'd be able to put it into the marketplace. It would be so damn good. People would buy it immediately. They would tell their friends to buy it. And year after year, I get $1 million of royalties, and that's a pretty good solution, right? So that's a very, very utilitarian, practical solution to begin the meta story problem. Okay, cool. So that's the big problem to solve. It's very thorny. We have no conception of what to do from here. So I like to go back to Aristotle. So Aristotle basically came up with these three sub questions when you're dealing with a massive big question. So we need to understand three foundational qualities of what a story actually is, right? If I want to write a story, I better know what a story is. So these three sub questions, if we can figure these out, they will come together and be able to teach us how to solve the big question. So the first big question is, what is the structure of a story? So all structure means is what's the whole, right? What's the whole thing? So to answer that question, you have to analyze the origins of story. So thankfully for all of you, I've been spending 30 years doing this, and Carl Jung did it for 60 years, and a lot of people have been doing this work for quite a long time. So you don't have to individually read, Virgil. So other people have read that for you. So so that's cool. And that's kind of what I've been doing for quite some time now. The whole Heroic Journey 2.0 course was about exploring the structure of story globally. So what that's going to do is that it enables us to sort of line up all of these phenomena, right? Like say we've got a big box of stuff, and we take all the pieces out of this big box, and we say, what do all these things have in common? What patterns do each of these stories share? So that will give us a global structure for story in general. And this includes nonfiction as well as fiction, right? So we're talking about the whole schmagilla of story. And so the global structure of story has been contemplated for centuries. And I think, we're getting closer to it. I think I'm feeling better and better about the story grid conception of what the global structure of a story is. And I'll get into that in a second. The second thing is another question that has, I kind of explored in the Big Ideas seminar. And this is, what is the function? Why do we have this? What does it do for us? What does storytelling as a function do for us? And my knee-jerk answer to this question is it helps us navigate the world, right? So these are simulations of possible problems that might emerge in our own lives. And so we love to read stories that are really engaging, because not only are we entertained, but we get to file kind of like do's and don'ts from these archetypical figures who are going through problems like we are going through. So they help us deal with navigational issues when things aren't going our way, right? So a new problem jumps up for us. And if we've read a million stories, we can use some of those heuristics and ideas from those stories to help us solve our problems, right? And this is, parents have been telling their kids stories for years about what they went through, right? And the reason is that they want to teach their kids to avoid the pitfalls and help them navigate through problems that they've gone through. That's like part of the main project for a parent, is to kind of tell the stories of the family and the friends and, your Aunt Jean went through this. And so that is the means, that's the function of a story. It's like this memory bank that people can go to under times of great stress. Cool. So that's the function. And it gives us adaptive advantage. It helps us survive, right? So on a scientific evolutionary point of view, story is the pivotal psychotechnology that's ever been created. I spent 30 hours in that course trying to make that point. So there you get it. You don't have to listen to my 30 hours. That's the point. All right. So that brings us to the third question. What's the organization of story? Now, all organization means are what are the subcomponent parts of that global whole, right? What are the levels underneath the whole that we can figure out so that we can break down that big, massive whole into solvable bits? So this is kind of like the big innovation that StoryGrid has come up with, right? It's like breaking down that huge problem into smaller pieces that are digestible, that we can wrap our minds around, and we can attack and defeat and fix. So just to, really go foundational. So what are we going to have? We're going to have this big whole structure of a story, and then we're going to break that whole into subcategories. Like, for example, story can be broken into two very easily: fiction and nonfiction, right? So we go, okay, we've got two kinds of stories, things that are trying to reflect historical events and things that are make-em-ups in somebody's head. All right, cool. All right, so then we can break those down further and further and further. And then ideally, we can keep breaking and breaking down and breaking down, and then we can get down to the unbreakable. Right? The unbreakable subcomponent of all stories. Now, this is something a lot of people haven't really thought about, but I've dedicated a lot of time over the last 5 years to get to this place. And it's my hypothesis, my proposition, that the unbreakable thing at the very bottom of story is the unexpected change event. It's what Carl Jung called, the ball of chaos. It's what I call the fear, the invisible fear gorilla. It's the unexpected moment of change that drives the story, right? This is the thing that you've got to have. It's the primary, you can't break it further down than that. Something happens that somebody doesn't expect, and that changes what they have to do, right? So we've got the whole, which I'll get into in a second. And then we've got this very, very primal unit. Now, here's what's really cool. In sort of problem solving theoretics, there are two ways to go about trying to solve a problem. There's called top down and bottom up. All right. So what top down is using a big global gestalt to think through using your mind, right? So what you would do is say, for example, we are StoryGrid people, right? So when a story problem emerges, what do? We go to our gestalt and we go, well, how's StoryGrid deal with this, right? Let me use my methodology, my StoryGrid frame, and intellectually try and break this problem down using that big global whole. All right, so that's one way of solving a problem. Another way of solving the problem is called from the bottom up. And that would mean, you know what? I have no idea how to solve this problem. My top-down processing is failing me. Shit, what am I gonna do? Well, I always recommend this. What do I say? I say drop down to the micro. What does that mean? Start writing a scene, right? So bottom up enables you to start thinking and allowing your sort of intuition and your implicit knowledge of story to surface. So when you get frozen and you get locked and you can't figure out an answer and you're at the bottom up, meaning you're writing a scene and you're lost, what do? You climb all the way up the top of the ladder to your gestalt. And you say, why am I writing this story anyway? Oh, this is a story about justice. Cool. All right, so what does this scene have to do with justice? Nothing. Oh, maybe I don't need it. It's that simple, right? But when you're at the top and you're having trouble, you go, I don't know how to make my character face the fact that blah, 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 blah. How am I going to do that? Well, try and write the scene, right? Just start with, she didn't know what to do. That's your first sentence. Go and see what happens. And usually what happens is something will surface that'll be really cool. All right, so this is the ways that I think through story problems. Now, there's a whole set of really cool things that can be really super confusing about these categories, right? So there's basically a whole bunch of different ontologies of looking at story. And all ontological systems are different frames. It's like putting on a different set of glasses. So you've got your psychology glasses. You've got your cognitive science glasses. So let me just pull up this spreadsheet that I've done that you all have access to. And I just did this morning. So please don't think this is, you know, I got some inspiration from the cosmos and it shed all this incredible light on me. But this is generally the way I approach a problem, right? I'm thinking like, oh, and of course that's stupid. I don't know what this thing is, but I can never clear it. Okay, this is a type of lens, right? So what power of glasses are we going to use to look at this problem? And there are a whole bunch of them, right? So basically, let me just walk it through. We've got the meta macro lens. What's that? Well, that's way, way, way beyond the surface. It's as if we got in a spaceship and we traveled to the edges of the universe and we're able to look at these stupid little beings on Earth and say, what are these idiots doing? Why are they, you know? So the meta macro is really, really global, massive gestalt. It's looking at the world through the lens of 5 billion years of history, right? It's pretending as if you were the creator of everything in the universe. And I kind of like being at that level. I don't know about you. But it makes me feel like, oh, if I could just get a really big point of view on this, then maybe I can make sense of things. And this, so this moves down to the macro. And what the macro is above the surface, right? So let me just go back to the meta macro for a second. The meta macro is sort of Socrates, he called it like second order thinking, right? It's thinking about the way you're thinking. So it's thinking about, it's like people go to, they go to psychotherapy. Because they want somebody else to help them think about the way they're thinking. And so the psychotherapist can say to you some things like, hey, have you thought about it in this way? Why do you think that you think everybody is your enemy? What do you think about that? And then you can start looking at your life through the prism of an omniscient point of view. And that's incredibly powerful. So, I was listening to an interview with Chris Rock the other day, and he's hit this moment in his life where he's looking at everything from the meta macro now, and it's really disturbing him. And he's got, you know, he's really in the belly of the beast. And it was the Howard Stern interview on Sirius. I recommend it. It's just to hear someone who's hit a place in his life where he's like, wow, I never realized that all that horrible shit that I went through during busing in 1968 has tormented me so for so long. It was brilliant. Anyway, so the meta macro is second order thought. Now the macro, this is above the surface. This is like the way we think from our own subjective point of view all the time. I wonder why they did that to me. What's going on with her? Why won't he... blah, 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 right? So this is our subjective way of viewing the world and saying, I don't understand why that object is behaving in the way that it is. the relationship between the objects and subjects in my life isn't making sense to me anymore. So this is all about your ego, right? This is about your ego. How am I going to solve my own freaking problems? I don't care about the depths of my soul. I just want to be able to get a new car. How am I going to go about doing that, right? So this is the macro above the surface. Well, if I want a new car, I got to get a better job, right? So it's very much about the utilitarian pursuit of goals. You have goal states, you go after them, you make a series of tactical choices to get to that goal state, and that's your macro point of view. Now, underneath that is the meso point of view. And this is in between the surfaces. It's in between above and it's in between on the surface. So the meso, and I just sort of came up with this morning, and I think it's really quite good. The meso is the intermediary, right? So it's the place in which the 10 other genres live in content. So we've got the worldview, which is your macro. I don't mean to sort of skip columns here, but I think it's the best explanation for meso. The meso are the tactical things, your specific wants in your hierarchy of needs. So you've got your want for safety, your want for love, your want for respect, all of that sort of abstract stuff sits in between your worldview, which actually programs you to go get this stuff the way you want it, and your physical action, your verbal and physical actions on the surface, which are your means, your motor actions in order for you to get it, right? So your worldview informs your body to go after and get the stuff that you want. So the meso is that place in between the actual motor actions of your body, which is the micro. That's the on the surface movement of your body through time, your verbal actions and your physical actions. And you are in, you're a goal state machine, right? No matter what we all think, we're all moving towards some goal state. Maybe it's like, as soon as I can get off this phone call, I can go have a bowl of Jell-O or something. I don't know. But we all have those goal states and we're all moving towards them. And we have micro and macro goal states. And the meso is sort of those intermediary goal states. It's, I want to get a good job after I graduate from college. That's a meso, you know? A meta macro would be, I want my life to be meaningful, right? So you can see these different levels of analysis. How well is the character solving their macro problems? How well is the character solving the meta macro problem? How well are they solving the meso problem and the micro problem? And the micro problem is literally just staying alive, right? It's the actions that you must take in order to protect yourself. These are the physiological and safety needs of Maslow's hierarchy. And as you are trying to solve your how do I survive problem, you're also adding on another layer, which is how am I going to thrive, right? The thrive solution is generated by your worldview. So your worldview goes, hey, body, after you get all that food in your body, after you get your water and you've got some clothes on, now you want to go get a car. And here are the things that, so you can see how these are like stacking on top of each other. Okay, so all this stuff that I just talked about is operating consciously, right? So these are all conscious thinking within your worldview. So your worldview is sort of like the operation central. It's the nucleus of story. And all of these other elements sort of operate from that worldview. Now, what's really cool, and we have Carl Jung and Freud to thank for this, is that there's a whole system of unconscious stuff too. Now, these levels of analysis are operating on your character too. And I have a hypothesis that I'll share with you in a couple of minutes, which I think is pretty cool. All right, so in the unconscious, you have your sub-micro. So, for example, a sub-micro unconscious just beneath the surface problem for my body, I was injured many times when I played football, right? So I have a limp. I have very clear things that affect my physicality. And actually, my ability to say certain phrases is affected by the cognitive damage that I sustained, right? But I don't consciously think about that, right? So those things happen to me as a character without me thinking about them. They're unconscious, but they clearly affect my ability to attain goals. I'm never going to run a 40-yard dash under 6 seconds ever again. Probably, I'm lucky if I could do it in 6 seconds, right? Okay, so that's the unconscious stuff. And then the sub-meso, these are also subconscious things of all the things that I've never gotten, right? All of my failures, all of my successes, these influence my conscious ability to even set goals, right? A lot of us always say, well, that I wouldn't even consider applying to that school or to that company because I'm just not good enough. Huh? That's crazy, right? That comes from the unconscious, right? So, and then you have the sub-macro, and I believe these actually go deeper across levels of analysis in terms of sociocultural that I'm not going to get into now. But basically, all of this way of thinking is the means by which you can start solving problems in your character, like things moving forward. How do I generate an innovative way to challenge my character? Where can the force of chaos come from? All of these levels can play, you can play with them in many different ways. So anyway, I promised to talk about this kind of cool thing that I thought of the other day. And it concerns the Heroic Journey 2.0. So let me just quickly go back to the spreadsheet here. And you'll see I have the genre forms here. So I've kind of laid out, you know, which genre is kind of dealing with these issues. So the Heroic Journey 2.0, this is meta macro stuff. This is the monomythic structure that are in the stories that work, right? These are the stories that sell forever and ever and ever. Meta macro Heroic Journey is totally in Pride and Prejudice, and it's also in Gilgamesh, and it's also in The Wizard of Oz, and it's also in I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and it's and on and on and on and on. I can talk like that because these patterns that are in the Heroic Journey repeat themselves, and they are the means by which we can really click into the desire of human beings to have their problems put into the proper context. All right, so you have your genre form, and then I have the five commandment level over here. And I always love to do the five commandments at different levels of analysis. And so that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about this kind of idea I came up with, which is the Heroic Journey 2.0. And I call this the cheat sheet. So if I had to boil down the Heroic Journey 2.0 into five commandments of storytelling, like, hey, Sean, I don't get all that crap that you did with all those 20 things and the four quadrants. Can you just break it down into five things for me based upon the five commandments of storytelling? So yeah, I can. And this is kind of what I came up with. So the Heroic Journey 2.0, remember, this is the meta macro abstraction. This is the thing that everyone sort of connects with in a story. So the global inciting incident is a worldview destroying invisible fear gorilla. All right. So what does that mean? It means that if you want to start a story that will connect with the Heroic Journey 2.0, the inciting incident needs to be an act of chaos that the protagonist cannot see. So for example, in The Wizard of Oz, the act of chaos is the cyclone, right? The cyclone comes into Dorothy's life and it wipes her out, right? It knocks her unconscious is what it does. Now, what is a cyclone? A cyclone has like a whole slew of little tornadoes within it. So a cyclone isn't just one kind of tornado. It's got a, like 20 different kinds in it. Instead of it being a contained unit of, say, a mile, it's like 100 miles in diameter. So it's got all these kinds of different tornadoes within the global cyclone, right? And the reason why I'm talking about this is that there's a reason why Frank Baum came up with a cyclone instead of a tornado. Because Dorothy has to grow up. It's a maturation story. Her worldview has to shift from being reliant upon parents and adult figures into becoming her own self, to be able to solve her own problems. So she can't see, literally, she can't see that the cyclone is an invisible fear gorilla. It's an act of chaos that's going to destroy her worldview and make her reemerge as a mature person capable of solving her own problems. So the same thing goes with the Hobbit. So Gandalf is a force of chaos. He comes to Bilbo and he knocks on the door and Bilbo doesn't even know who he is, right? The beginning of the Hobbit, Bilbo does not know who Gandalf is. He's invisible to him. And then he's, oh, right, you're the wizard. Well, okay. But he's still an invisible fear gorilla because Gandalf is a force that's saying to Bilbo, you've got to get off your ass and do something with your life. And the way you're going to do that is go on this adventure. So those are two global inciting incidents that the protagonist does not understand until the very end of the story. And even then, it's not that perfectly clear. Now, where do these things come from? They come from the unconscious, right? So when we are growing up, our bodies hit these stages and our minds hit stages too. So when we're Dorothy's age, our mind's like, hey, it's time for us to kick into a new gear. So they actually bring about these drop-in moments of chaos that force us to level up our cognitive capacity. So that's the global inciting incident. The turning point progressive complication, and this arrives right about halfway in the story. And, you know, go watch movies, go watch stories, see what happens at midpoint. Basically what happens is that the worldview that the protagonist had at the beginning of the story shatters. Everything that they thought was true becomes not true. So that's what happens at midpoint. And it's because this invisible fear gorilla basically shatters the glasses that the protagonist is wearing. Cool. All right. So what's the crisis? Well, the crisis comes just past the all is lost moment. Now, the all is lost moment is when the protagonist, facing the fact that their worldview is in smithereens, they fall into the vortex of chaos and they reach a level where they're like, shit, I don't know. Nothing makes sense anymore. What am I going to do? Right? That is the crisis. What am I going to do in the face of chaos? When I cannot predict my future, I cannot be certain of anything. What do I do? And this all boils down to the existential dilemma that, you know, Samuel Beckett was talking about. What do I do? How do I go on when nothing makes any sense? Well, this is the crisis. How do I keep moving when I can't seem to get my shit together? Do I just stop and quit and just say everything's meaningless, or do I go on, right? This is the big existential crisis that all of us face all of the time. When things don't work out for us, we bust our ass and the story doesn't work. What do we do? Do we quit? or do we go on? This is the crisis. This is why the writer and the story have the same heroic journey as they're creating it. All right, so the climax of the heroic journey is that if the protagonist decides to go on, they're heroic. Oh, shit. Well, I guess I have to solve this problem anyway. I guess I have to do the best that I can with the information that I have as I'm moving forward. And I guess I'm going to have to do the best that I can. That's heroic. That's heroism. That's all it is. It doesn't have anything to do with destroying the empire. It's simply moving forward when shit isn't going your way and saying, ah, what the hell? But might as well keep moving forward. Things have been meaningful to me in the past. Maybe they will in the future. That's heroism. And the other one is anti-heroism, where you go, fuck it. I'm just going to have fun. I'm not going to worry about shit anymore. Excuse my language. But that is the anti-heroic, like, well, I'm only on the planet for an X number of years, so I might as well get drunk every night, or I might as well X every night, or I might as well, you know, manipulate people to get me what's good for me. I might as well blah, blah, blah. That's anti-heroic, because you're basically saying that everything is meaningless. So this is the heroic journey. This is it. And then the resolution of the story is the result. Like, what happens? So what happens if the hero continues to move forward but doesn't get anything? Does that mean that their choice was stupid? No. Does it mean if the anti-heroic gets rewarded with lots of things, does that mean that's the answer? No. But you can see this is about navigating paradox. The paradox of our life is that we live in order and we live in chaos at the same time. So meaning is generated by the heroic figure. Why? Because even if they don't get what they're shooting for, other people see their actions. Other people say, oh man, well, I guess I have to go on because X went on. They continued to work towards some meaning in their life. Now, if I don't, this is what a parent's for, right? You know, your kids see you fail all the time, but they also see you getting up and going to work all the time too, or your cousins or whatever, right? So it's our actions, our ability to continue moving forward, to try to find meaning, to work together. That is the heroic choice. And that is the resolution of the story. So you can see how a hero can die in the end of a story and still we feel good, right? We're like, hey, you know what? They gave it all they had. Yeah, they died, but their death was meaningful. So this is generally a great way of looking at a story, because you can say to yourself or your client, am I hitting these moments? Is this clear? Am I clearly making a choice that I'm putting forward heroic person or anti-heroic? So you can do the anti-heroic story, but it does generate meaning through its meaninglessness, right? So the whole point of Mad Men, the television series, at the end of that series, it was meaningful because the character was meaningless, in my estimation, right? So the fact that this character didn't find any meaning in life, it said to me, this is a cautionary tale. I don't want to live my life like Don Draper, or I'm going to end up a miserable bastard whose only meaning in life is to make more money and to sell Coca-Cola to innocent people or whatever. So you can see how there's a paradox, and these paradoxical endings, you know what they sound like? Real life. Because nobody ever gets everything that they want. And so when you finish the story, you go, you know what? That was really realistic because X, Y, and Z. So it's because the writer is abiding these general concepts. All right, so I've gone on way too long with this, as I'm wont to do, but I think, you know, a lot of times we get mired in the detail. We get mired in all of the levels of analysis, you know, my beats, my scenes, my sequences, my value shifts, my polarity, blah, 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 blah. And we can lose the gestalt. This is the gestalt. This is the point. So when in doubt, you know, just go like, am I connecting to that heroic journey thing about having the courage to existentially go on with one's life? It sounds kind of like, really, that's it? Well, we've all been there when that seems like impossible. Like, there's no way I can go on any longer, right? We've all hit that moment. But what do? We just keep going on. Right. And that's what Samuel Beckett, that's why I think Samuel Beckett is a cut above the other absurdist writers post World War II, because he came to that conclusion in the absurdist dramas that he created. It's like, you don't really have a choice. If you're a human being, you got to go on. You got to keep searching for meaning, or we're screwed. So, all right. So I'm going to turn it over to Valerie now so that she can start pumping me with the questions. And let me unshare my screen here. Great. Okay.
All right. So the first question comes from Scott, and he writes, I have struggled with my protagonist's goal, which sets up conflict, crisis, the entire story arc. The challenge is that the further the protagonist proceeds into the story, he learns new things that make his old goal obsolete. So by the middle of the second act, his motivation is redirected to a new goal. Can progressive complications be used that way to change the trajectory of the protagonist's worldview and object of desire?
Well, I think I just addressed a lot of that, Scott. I think what you have just described is the midpoint climax, right? So you've described the moment, and you're on the right track, obviously, because you've identified this organically without this meta macro formalization of the heroic journey 2.0. So the important thing to keep in mind is that the objects of desire, here's another way of looking at it that I think is kind of cool. The objects of desire are the wants and the needs, right? So I think I'm going to change the language. I'm just going to tweak it. So an object of desire is to attain a want. So it's all about having. If I have that Ferrari, then I will be identified as a successful person. That's an object of desire. Now, a need, I think, is a subject of desire, right? So we want to subjectively fulfill a need. And a need is a being, not a having, right? So in the midpoint climax is the moment when the protagonist's object of desire becomes meaningless. Right? It's when that object of desire, they discover, oh my gosh, either they get it or they don't get it, but they discover it's not, it's blowing up their worldview. Because think about it in terms of goal attainment. If I get the Ferrari, everything is going to be great. And what happens when you buy the Ferrari? Everything isn't great. So thematically, that's what's happening, is that the want is blown up into smithereens at midpoint climax, and it shoots the protagonist down into the depths of despair. So that dissolution into the chaotic realm results in all is lost. Everything that I've always wanted has proven to not bring me happiness. Therefore, perhaps everything that I'm doing and all my worldview is screwed up. And that hits the all is lost. And you go, well, what am I supposed to do? And then the need emerges. The need of the specific genre that you're talking about, like the need to bring the person to justice, right? If it's a crime story. So usually what happens at midpoint climax is that the master detective or the cop, they falsely accuse somebody or they screw up. And the investigation is blown up. It's like in Clarice Starling, like she screws everything up. And it doesn't look like they have any chance of getting Buffalo Bill. And not only that, Hannibal Lecter's free. Holy shit, did she blow the pooch, right? Everything that she wanted got blown apart. Not only that, she's not going to become a hotshot FBI agent. That's what she wants. She wants to be the kick-ass FBI agent, and it blows up. And then at the bottom, what emerges? The need. What's the need? It's to, I'm going to like start crying. The need is to safeguard an innocent life. She wouldn't be able to live with herself if she does not plumb the depths of her cognitive capacity, physical capacity, spiritual capacity, everything. She's got to lay it all on the line and do whatever has to be done. Damn the torpedoes, because she cannot live with herself if the victim is skinned alive by that psychopath. And there she goes. And at that point, we, the audience, yeah, we want to see what happens, but no matter what, we know Clarice Starling is going to be okay, right? We know she has actualized. She has figured out the meaning of her life. I'm stronger than other people. Therefore, I must use my strength to protect those who need me. That's meaning. And there she goes, right? So the object of desire gets you to midpoint. And then it's all about discovering the subject of need by the bottom of that all is lost. And then that'll push you right into the ending payoff. And the reader is going to be locked and loaded with you if you clearly show that the protagonist has hit rock bottom and has decided, fuck it, I'm going on anyway. I'm gonna keep going. There's no choice. And I'm gonna deal with shit as it happens to me instead of programming myself to hit these markers so that I reach this level of success at the blah, 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 right? That's being. It's context-driven, depending upon the phenomena that emerge in the moment, not planning for the Ferrari, but moving forward. All right, so next question. I'll go a little longer since I screwed up the screen share. So your question's on there. I'll do my best to answer it.
Okay, the next question comes from Esty. She was wondering what resources she can use to help broaden the range of emotions on the value spectrum. And she gives performance genre as an example, shame, flawed, honored, respect. So how do you fill in the gaps between the general values that we've provided already on the cheat sheet?
Sure. All right. So you got to remember that the content genres are just this wonderful constraint system that takes you into very specific moments. Now, those specific moments and the value shifts that are really driving, let's say, it's probably a quarter of, it's basically 20 scenes, right? So you get to play around with other values in the other 40 to 60 scenes, right? Because we have to think about It's kind of like the woman who swallowed a fly, you know, that song, and she keeps swallowing different animals until she dies. Well, that's what's going on, right? So the tactics that the character uses to attain their goals change. So the scenes, it's sort of like, well, if I want to, I'm sorry, this is on the top of my brain pan because I've got a kid in school, but if I want to go to that famous college, what's the rubric to go to the famous college, right? Well, get good grades, sure. What else, right? So then what we do is we just go, oh, community service. So I have to do community service to get the star that I can put on my chest. So then the goal becomes a tactical goal. How do I do meaningful community service so that I can get the star on my chest? Instead of how can I do something meaningful for my community, right? So the tactic can be like, how do I convince this person who runs the Boys and Girls Club of Hartford, Connecticut to give me a kid? I need a kid and I need to see that kid at least 4 times a week for 3 years. Can you help me with that problem? So it's not about actually helping the kid. It's about attaining another goal. Therefore, you can have a scene where the character's going in to get something from somebody to get a larger goal later on. So let's say it's a performance story. And let's say the performance is they're going to do a play. And the protagonist is sort of a down on their heels actor, which is every actor. And so that actor decides the only way I'm ever going to get a starring role is if I produce the play myself, right? So they need to put on the play so that they can perform and show who they are in front of the important people who will give them jobs in the future. But they have to convince the person who owns the barn that they're going to put the play on to let them do it. And so what are the tactics that actor uses to get the barn owner to let her use the barn? And boy, there's 1,000 different ideas that you can come with there, right? Appeal to their sense of community, appeal to their whatever. So, you know, at what's the line that they're gonna cross? I'll do this amount of stuff in order to get that tactical goal so that it will advance my further goal. And so you can change those values all the time. So it will be like seduce the barn person to get the barn. And that has nothing to do with the performance genre. It has to do with seduction skills, right? So unseduced to seduced could be this value shift in that particular scene. However, it has nothing to do with whether or not they perform well on the stage. I hope that makes sense. So you only need to really drive the global value on those 5 commandments for each of the 4 quadrants of your story. The other things, that's where you get to play around and say, well, what would I have to do to get this character to secure the barn for the play? What kind of scene can I play out there? So I hope that works.
Okie dokie. And this question comes from Heather. Do you have any tips for applying the story grid methodology to short stories?
Yeah, it's the exact same stuff. What's the global inciting incident of the short story? One of my favorite short stories is A Small Good Thing by Raymond Carver. The global inciting incident is that a little boy is hit by a car and he's put into the hospital. And we get to see what happens across multiple domains of life in that story. So it happened to be the boy's birthday. And so the man who owns the bakery, you know, he's he bakes these beautiful cakes, and a lot of people just never show up to pick up the cake. And he's out the money of creating the cake. And then it says, "Happy birthday, Jimmy," on it. And he can't sell the cake because it says, "Happy birthday, Jimmy," on it. And so he starts calling the parents and saying, you know, "When the hell are you going to pick up the cake?" And they stop. They're not answering the phone. He's leaving nasty messages. Meanwhile, the parents are at the hospital because their son has been hurt. And it's a beautiful story because it doesn't end in the way that you think it's going to end. And so that's a short story that has multiple points of view. And it also operates a dramatic irony, right? So we can see the point of view of the baker and the point of view of those poor parents and the point of view of the son in multiple ways. And those five commandments are in every single scene. And at the end of this story, we find community and love. And a horrific accident emerges, love and community. So a short story is exactly like a novel. It's exactly like anything else. It's far more difficult to write a short story in many instances that has that kind of power. Alice Munro, I mean, just read anything that she writes. And you're just like, at the end, you're like, you know, it's like a solar plexus punch. And that's because she's using the heroic journey 2.0 in everything. She's using all of the different kinds of content genres. There's action, there's worldview. She's got it all going, right? So just think of a short story as a condensed novel. And instead of thinking about 20 core scenes, think about five moments, right? What are my five moments? What's my inciting incident? What turns the thing? What's the crisis? What's the climax? And what's the resolution? For the Carver story, the inciting incident is an accident. The turning point progressive complication is when the boy dies. The crisis is when the baker calls and finally gets them on the phone after the boy dies, and he's screaming at the mother for not picking up the fucking cake. And the climax is she tells him, "I couldn't pick up the cake because my kid's dead." The climax is the baker makes bread and he has them come over and he sits with them while they're grieving. And that's a short story that's as good as any novel or any movie. And it's so freaking sad, but it's so beautiful. And it's so meaningful because he brought his gift. Anyway, see, just even saying the five commandments of a great story makes you fucking cry, right? That's what we're after. So do a short story. Come up with five commandments that can make all your friends cry, and you're on the way.
All righty. The final question is from Dana. Do all stories have an external genre?
Yeah, they do. I think the external genre in every story is the action story. So the action story is the actual movement of a body. Instead of thinking it as you know, Michael Bay action story, it's not that. What it is literal, the movement of the body and the mouth through time. And so the actions of, so if you go down to all those subgenres of action, you'll see that they're operating at multiple levels of the collective cognitive grammar, collective cultural grammar. So you have the individual against the environment, the individual against the individual against the state, the individual against, I forget what the last one is, time, right? So each of those are existential problems, aren't they? These are things that we face all the time. So the action story, if you just plumb down there, you can use those and apply a lot of the constraints that happen in action stories abstractly to higher levels of on the content genres. So when I talk about action, I'm talking about on the surface movement, the literal. It's like when we analyze a scene, the first question we ask is, what literally happened in this scene? Kid dies, baker makes bread to bring solace to grieving parents. That's literally what happens. Kid dies, baker makes bread to bring solace to grieving parents. That's the action on the surface. So then Carver's like, how do I do that? Oh, well, if I use, and Leslie's point of view beat is coming out in November, which is going to be great. But this is part of dealing with narrative device. So Carver thought to himself, how do I make that action play? Right? If I do it just from the point of view of the parents, it's going to get like really melodramatic really quickly. And I'll feel like I'm manipulating people because I killed a kid in order to show grief, right? Then he's like, ooh, why don't I do it from the point of view of the poor baker who's barely making his life in this bakery? And what's the phenomena of being a baker doing birthday cakes? A lot of people don't show up for those birthday cakes. That must send somebody over that. And so their anger overwhelms them. And then you've got the action, the external genre is about the literal movement through time. And so that becomes an individual against individual action story, right? The baker is gonna make those MFs pay for not picking up that fucking cake. That's an action story. How do I get revenge? These people have no idea what they're doing. How am I gonna get revenge, right? It's not Michael Bay revenge. But it is revenge, right? So what's the action of the motivation of the characters such that it's keeping the action moving? So action story is the external genre, even for Finnegan's Wake. He has to get through a day, or maybe that's the other one. I don't know. whichever one. Remembrance of things past. The guy's got to get out of bed, you know? Is he going to get out of bed or not? Not one of my favorites.
It hardly shows. Thank you so much, Sean. We really appreciate your time today. Thanks, everyone, for showing up in the forum.
Bye.